Bibles and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And I want to talk this morning about making the right investment. Now, it's going to be a little different than what you think about when you think about investments. I don't know how many times I've sat in a room with somebody and talked to them, and they would say something like this: if I had my life to live over, if I could just do that again, I wish I hadn't done that, or I wish I had not said that, or I wish I had listened to my parents, or I wish I'd listened to my teachers, or to my coach, or to my grandparents. And so much of people's lives is spent on wishing they could go back and clean up something they messed up. Wishing that they could somehow fix something that is broken. But you can't go back. And if nothing else we've learned over these past few months since September 11th, we've learned this: whatever you're going to do, you better do it now. And Americans have started reevaluating their priorities based on one simple thing: the uncertainty of life and the uncertainty of the moment of death. You see, what we need today is a proper perspective on life. And we need to have a worldview that gives us a proper perspective, because your worldview determines every decision that you make. You say, well, I don't have a worldview. Yes, you do. Your worldview is the grid through which everything you think and everything you do passes. It's your thought process. It's your decision-making process. Your worldview determines how you respond and act and react. Now, there are four attitudes that impact our worldview, and I want us to look at them as we begin this message this morning, because you've got to understand these impact how you think, how you act, how you live, what you're thankful for, what you live for, what you're willing to die for. Number one, do you believe in God? That's the first thing that affects a person's worldview. Do you believe in God? Do you believe in the God of the Bible, or just some presence that's out there floating in the universe, some distant deity? Do you believe in a personal God that cares personally about what's going on in your life, or is God far removed from you? Is He the God of the Bible? Is He the all-knowing, all-powerful God who hears the prayers of people when they cry out to Him? You see, your view of God affects how you handle life. If you don't believe that God is who He said He is, He will be the last person you turn to in a crisis, not the first one. Second question: if you're going to develop a worldview, then you have to ask the question, what is ultimate reality to you? What is ultimate reality to you? In other words, is it based on your senses, or is it based on eternal principles? Is ultimate reality to you what you can taste and feel and smell and touch? Or is ultimate reality to you based on an eternal view of life? If ultimate reality is only what you see in this life, that's going to affect how you live your life. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. But if ultimate reality is based on who God is and who you are in your relationship with God, it affects how you view this life in a world that says, grab for all the gusto you can get and get it now. Third question: not only do you believe in God and what is ultimate reality, but what are your values? What are your values? Because you see, your values are birthed out of ultimate reality and what you believe about God. Are your values situational? Is right always right and wrong always wrong, or does it just depend? Do you kind of catch the wind and see how things are going before you decide where you stand on an issue? You see, your values are built out of your virtues, and virtues are non-changing. Your values come out of what ultimate reality is and what you believe about God. If you believe He's the God of the Bible, and if you believe that life is more than this life, it is about eternity and an eternal perspective, then your values are not going to be just conditioned by what am I getting now and what am I doing now. Your values are more long-term, and you think in terms of absolutes, which our society doesn't think in terms of. That's why the book of Ecclesiastes is a postmodern book, because it deals with those who do not believe in absolutes. Number four, what is man? What is man? And you see, what you believe about man determines what you believe about abortion and euthanasia. Because if man is just another form of animal life, then he's not valuable to you. If man is just something that's evolved over time, then he's not valuable to you. But if you view man as created in the image of God, then the people that you come in contact have eternal value because they've been created. They may not be acting like it, but they have been created in the image of God. So the question you have to ask yourself is, what is man? And the reason that man has no value in our society, and the reason that millions of babies are aborted every year, and the reason that Dr. Kevorkian will continue to increase in people like him, is the very simple fact that life doesn't have value for people because man is not created in the image of God. He's just a living animal. And until you view man as a living, created being in the image of God with a soul that will spend eternity in heaven or in hell, you will never have a high opinion of man. Man was created a little lower than the angels. In our society, he's worthless. And that's why suicide is a leader in America more than any other nation in the world, because we have so little value on life. Now in Ecclesiastes 7, Solomon is giving us a worldview. And what he's done is, you remember in these previous chapters, he's been talking about this under the sun approach to life. And he's been giving us an apologetics letter. Now he's going to change his tactic. And he's going to change his style, and he's going to bombard us with proverbs and short statements, just like he did in the book of Proverbs. And the reason he does that is he's giving us a good and better. And 11 times in this one chapter, you find the word better than or better. He's trying to tell us what is better. And so look at it, if you would, beginning in verse 1. A good name is better than a good ointment. And the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. And so what he's saying here is that if you're going to make the right investments in life, if you have the right worldview, you have a high opinion of God, of man, of values, of ultimate reality, then you're going to invest, listen now, you're going to invest in having a good name. Because your name is all you've got. You can lose your money, but you can keep your name. And so the first question you ask yourself today is, how will you be remembered? Now, he does a play on words here in verse 1. The Hebrew word name is Shem, and the Hebrew word for cologne is Shemen. What he's saying is that a good name is a fragrance that you cannot resist. Unlike cologne or perfume that can wear off after a while, and you need to renew it, a good name attracts and a good name endures. And he says a good name is better than good ointment. Proverbs 22:1, if you want to write it by Ecclesiastes 7:1, says a good name is to be more desired than great wealth. Favor is better than silver and gold. You ever wondered why, you've never wondered about this, why nobody calls their son Adolf anymore? What would you think about a parent that named their son, here's our new baby boy, 8 pounds, 4 ounces. We're so proud of him. What'd you name him? Judas. Well, what's your baby's full name? Benedict Arnold Smith. You see, once a name gets tarnished, everybody is affected by it. You and I are affected by how we name our children by the people in the Bible who have bad names. And their bad names are a witness against them. And so he says a good name, having a good name is more important and more valuable than good ointment. But then he goes on and says the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Now that's the last thing we want to talk about, that the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. But the scripture says we're supposed to weep when they are born and rejoice when they die. The psalmist says, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his godly ones. Now, our society's got it mixed up. You know why? It's very simple. Our society doesn't believe that there's life beyond the grave. The Christian does. We believe that there's life beyond the grave. And the last thing we want to talk about is death at a time of Thanksgiving. But listen, folks, there's going to come a day when every one of us will find an empty chair at a table at Thanksgiving. How will we be remembered on that day? How will our family talk about us on that day? You see, what he's saying is this world is passing away. And you need to live your life and watch your reputation in light of the fact that eternity is ahead, and how you will be remembered in time is determined by what you do right now. The psalmist said, teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Now, when he deals with death, he's taking us away from secondary issues. We've come into church today and we've talked about football games and we've talked about turkey and we've talked about traveling and we've talked about a lot of other things. But when you talk about death, you knock away all the secondary issues. Because it reminds us that every one of us is going to die. And since September 11th, we've talked a lot about death in this country. And families have started talking more about what's important. And you know what we've learned since September 11th? We've learned Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Because now we know the names of firemen and policemen and emergency workers that we took for granted before, but now we've sat and we've watched on television and we've read in the papers and we've read in news magazines the names of these people who gave their lives in heroic efforts. We know the names of the men who tried to take over the plane to get it back before the terrorists crashed it into the White House. We know those people now. And their names are honored now. They're considered heroes. Why? Because a good name was important to them, and it was important to them even in the face of death, to do what they had been tasked to do and to do it well. For most people, their names appear in the paper two times, the day you're born and the day you die. That's the only time most of us will ever get our names in the paper. But between our birth and our death, we make our name. Now, here's something that you need to write down. And you need to remember this, and especially those of you that are parenting young children, because it will change the way you raise your children. At birth, we dream of what a child will become. At death, we know. At birth, we dream of what a child will become. All our hopes are wrapped up into that birth of that child, but at death we know. You see, the lessons are based on facts at death. When a child is born into a home, we look at that child and say, oh, that child could become a doctor, that child could become a lawyer, that child could become the president of the United States. I don't know who would want that job, but that child could become anything. That child could become an entrepreneur, that child could become anything. But at death, the facts are there about what that child became. And I've been in ministry now over 30 years, and I can tell you, I've buried some teenagers that at death, not only did they die, but every hope that mom and dad had for them was killed.
because they made dumb choices and stupid decisions. Because you see, at death, there's no covering up the facts. The facts are there. There are no do-overs. You can't come back. And a kid that dies because they're drunk leaves a testimony that lasts for all their lives and a grief on their families that cannot be taken away. You see, you better watch your name, because you don't know when you don't get a chance anymore to decide how your name will be remembered. And once you have set your name before people, good or bad, it may follow you for eternity. And so in Proverbs 10:7, he says, "The memory of the just is blessed, but the name of the wicked shall rot." And he says in Ecclesiastes 7, the last part of the verse, "The living takes it to heart," or literally, "gives to his heart." In other words, what he's saying there is the living understand what death will do, and they understand a good name, and they take it to heart, and they remember that there is an eternity to face. I heard a story about two guys that lived in a small town, and they were mean as snakes. I mean, they were just sorry, ornery, rotten guys. They'd been mean all their lives. They'd fought everybody. They'd stolen from everybody. Nobody liked them. The older brother died. Younger brother came to the Baptist preacher, and he said, "Pastor, I want you to do my brother's funeral." He said, "Well, I don't know. You know, your brother, he said it would be cold in Hades before he ever came into a church." He said, "I want you to do the funeral, and I want you to do it in church." He said, "Well, I don't know." And the guy said, "Well, I'll pay you $100,000 if you do my brother's funeral." And of course, you know, Baptist preachers being what we are, said, "Well, it must be God's will, you know." So he says, "I'll pay you $100,000, but here's the deal." He said, "You cannot say anything bad about my brother. I want you to make him a saint. Make him sound like a saint. And if you don't, I'll kill you." So the Baptist preacher got up, caskets in front of the church. He got up and he said, "We all know who we're here to look at today and who we're here to remember today. Every one of you in this room knows this man and you know the story of his life. I don't need to say anything about that. I don't need to remind you of anything about his life. All I want to say today is very simply this. Compared to his brother, he's a saint." How will you be remembered? Second question. How do you handle correction? Verse 5. You see, this is where you let other people invest in you. How you handle correction is where you let other people invest in you. Verse 5, "It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool, and this too is vanity," or futility. I want to ask you to turn to Proverbs chapter 10. We're going to walk through Proverbs on what it says about heeding correction. One of the things we look for when we call staff is we look for three characteristics, and you're familiar with these three characteristics. And when we look at a staff member and we look at their wives, we look at three things. Are they faithful? Are they available? And are they teachable? Because you see, if you're not teachable, you can't teach other people. If you're not willing to be led, you can't lead. If you're not willing to listen, nobody should have to listen to you. So are they faithful, are they available, and are they teachable? I've got a young man that was one of my interns when I was in youth ministry, and he's now serving at one of the largest churches in Birmingham as their singles minister. And the thing I always appreciated about him was this. If I ever told him something, I never had to tell him but one time. I mean, I could chew him out. I could say, "You know, bud, I'm going to tell you something. If you don't get this straight, it's going to kill you one day." And I never had to repeat it again. He got it. He figured it out. One of the reasons why I loved him and one of the reasons why I loved serving with him is because I didn't have to go back and redo all the time. He just figured it out and said, okay, that must be something that God wants to teach me and something that I need to learn. Whether he agreed with it or not, he took it in and he prayed about it and he processed it and he said, okay, I need to apply that to my life. I've told you the story, it bears repeating, when I was talking to Vance Havner one day and I was waxing eloquent. I was young, had black hair then. And I was real young and I was just going on and on and on and on and on about what I was doing. And he put his hand on my arm and he said, now son, I've been young and I've been old and you've just been young. So why don't you shut up for a while? I did. And I learned a valuable lesson that day. You need to let people come into your life who can tell you not what you want to hear, but what you need to hear. I had an incident not long ago, and I wasn't sure about how I handled it, and so I sent an email to four men in this church, and I asked them to honestly respond to me about how they felt I'd handled it. I got a variety of responses. Some said okay, some said not too good, you know. But you know what? They were honest responses from men that I trust and value and respect. And the rebuke was received because I knew one thing. They had my best interests at heart. They didn't have a burr under their saddle. They weren't out trying to do anything to hurt me. They were trying to help me. And when you got somebody that tries to help you when they rebuke you, they're doing it for your good, whether it feels like it's good at the time or not. So Proverbs chapter 10, let's just walk through Proverbs very quickly. Y'all are going to have to listen quicker or the leftovers are going to sit on the stove for a while. Proverbs 10 and verse 17, he is on the path of life who heeds instruction, but he who ignores reproof goes astray. Proverbs 12 in verse 1. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates reproof is stupid. Proverbs 15 in verse 5. A fool rejects his father's discipline, but he who regards reproof is sensible. Proverbs 25 in verse 12. Proverbs 25 and verse 12. Like an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold is a wise reprover to a listening ear. Proverbs 27. You see, the same person that wrote Ecclesiastes wrote Proverbs, and he says the same thing over and over again. Anytime God says something once, you need to remember it. When he says it this much, you better pay attention to it. God says that there's going to be a need in your life for people to hold you accountable, for people that you answer to, for people that you listen to, for people that you receive what they say. Doesn't mean they're always right. They may not be, but you need to listen and process it and take it in and take it before God. Proverbs 27, verse 5. Better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. By the way, an enemy is a person that tells you what you want to hear. They're the ones that never tell you anything you don't want to hear. They just tell you what you want to hear. Proverbs 27 and verse 17. Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Proverbs 29 and verse 1. A man who hardens his neck after much reproof will suddenly be broken, notice what he says, beyond remedy. In other words, you can reach a point in your life where you don't listen to people trying to help you and you're broken beyond remedy. You can't fix. You've messed up so much. You may can get forgiveness from God, but you can't fix what you've messed up. It's gone too far. And then in verse 15 of chapter 29, the rod and reproof give wisdom, But a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. How do you handle correction? You see, if you and I are not teachable, then we hit a lid in our life about how much God can use us. God can only use teachable people. And if we're not teachable, if we're not willing to learn, then we hit a lid in our lives where God can no longer stretch us out of our box, get our attention, talk to us, deal with us, maybe sometimes through circumstances, sometimes through other people. Now, I'm not talking about receiving every person that walks in your life to say something. God spoke through a donkey one time. He hasn't done it since. Now, I've had some donkeys try to speak to me. But you know, if you're not there standing shoulder to shoulder with somebody, and if you're not in the trenches with them, you probably have not earned the right to rebuke. It is only when you stood in the trenches shoulder to shoulder and said, my blood for your blood, my heart, your heart, do you have a right to say, hey, you know what? You don't need to be doing that. You see, there are people that have earned that right in my life over 12 years of pastoring this church because they have stood shoulder to shoulder with me in some tough times. Steve Moore has earned that right because of almost 30 years of friendship. He can say to me, you don't need to do that. And I can listen to him because I know he loves me enough that he wants my best interest. I'm not talking about you just waiting for people to come run over you and treat you like dirt. But I'm talking about who are the three or four people in your life that you have given permission to say to you, that's not right. And by the way, if you're married, the first one needs to be your spouse. If your spouse can't tell you the truth, your marriage is in trouble whether you know it or not. The first one needs to be your spouse. And then you need to have men, you need to have some men. Men, this is not for women to come and rebuke you. And women, it's not for you to, it's for men to, it's men eyeball to eyeball with men. Ladies with ladies. Why? Because you don't put yourself in a shoulder to shoulder, I'm willing to die for you with somebody else's wife or somebody else's husband. Because the devil can get into that relationship. So you got to be careful. But you have to be willing to be open to people to speak to your life and speak into your life and talk to you about things that need correction. Now, let's look at the last one. How do you approach life? And we're going to go through this one quickly. First thing is, how do you handle pressure? Verse 7, for oppression makes a wise man mad and a bribe corrupts the heart. What he's talking about pressure there is he's really talking about our culture. You know, bribery, manipulation, cut corners, shady deals, being bought off, turning your head the other way, do whatever you got to do to make the company make a profit, doctor the books. He's saying that's pressure. And the pressure of our culture is this quarter's got to make more money than last quarter, and we've got to keep going up, and we're under pressure in the world in which we live, which has no view of God, which does not believe in absolutes, does not believe in ultimate reality, doesn't think man has any worth, and employees are basically a piece of meat that gets paid to work for them. In that culture, you and I are told, compromise. Take a bribe. Turn your head the other way. Ignore what's going on. You see, even wise people become fools when money's involved. And that's the thing you need to remember, is when it gets down to somebody offering you money to forget or to turn your head or to not write a report or to doctor the report, then you have just gotten in a situation that you need to figure out how you're going to get out of. Because that will be a constant temptation until you settle that issue, and you'll not settle it unless your worldview is right. Second thing he says is, how do you handle trying times? Verse 8. The end of the matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Patience is one of those virtues that's in short supply. I want patience, I just don't want what it takes to get it. You know, I hate to wait. How many of you hate to wait? I mean, I hate to wait in line. You know, if I'm the third car in a fast food line, it seems like forever. No matter what line I get in at the bank, it's the slow one. Does anybody else get in that line? It's always the slow one. You know, now before I got there, boom, 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 they were whipping them through. There's somebody in that bank that's going, cat's coming. Okay. $1. $2. $1. $2. I hate to wait in traffic. You know, this light at Whispering Pines and Dawson Road at 5 o'clock, you know, it's not a wait. I know it's, listen, I've lived in Atlanta, I've lived in Kansas City, and I've lived in Fort Worth. I know what waiting in traffic is. This is not waiting in traffic, but I've lived here so long, now I'm waiting in traffic. And I'm sitting at that light, and you know, because the guy doesn't anticipate the green and have it right here, boy, ready, you know, he's burning rubber just waiting for the light to go. You know, he doesn't anticipate it. And then the lady in front of me, she's fixing her eye makeup. And I'm going, for the love of God, can somebody just drive? Patience is, you know, trials, James says, produce patience. And I got to tell you, there's some moments in my life when I've told God, you know, I've got about all the character development I can stand right now. You know, if you want to develop some character, I got some characters you can develop, but I've got about all I can handle right now. But how do you handle tough times? Notice the haughtiness of spirit. He ties in to this phrase, patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. You know what haughtiness of spirit is? I don't have to wait for God. I don't have to do what God says. I can take matters into my own hands. I can do it my way. I can live life on my terms. I don't have to wait for God. I don't have to listen to God. I don't have to let God take me through this process. I'll just jump ahead of God and do it my way. That's haughtiness of spirit. He deals with frustrations in verse 9. Don't be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. The most damaging emotion known to man is anger. It was the cause of the first murder. And anger has hurt more homes and more lives than we can possibly count up. We live in a day of road rage and short fuses and hot heads. And he says, don't be eager in your heart to be angry. And that's a hard emotion to control. James says it this way in 1:19, be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. The last one, how will you handle today? Verse 10, do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. What he's telling us there is the wise person lives in the present. The wise person lives in present tense. Now, let's all be honest. The good old days were sometimes not as good as we remember them. Sometimes in our good old days, we forget the bad things in the good old days. Time has a way of giving us selective memory. You know, I look back, oh boy, those were good days. Well, I don't know. And my dad used to tell me, he said, you know, people go talk about the good old days. He said, the good old days for me was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I had to go get the wood to start the fire while everybody else was under the quilts. You know, you hear people talking about the good old days. They walked uphill in the snow 9 miles to school and uphill in the snow 9 miles back. You know, the good old days when you had a family of 5 or 6 and you had one car. And it didn't run half the time. The good old days when You could watch the sunlight come through the cracks in your walls. Well, some of you have that now, but you know, sometimes we get off on the good old days, and he says, don't do that. Don't live in the past. Oh, you know, it just used to be so wonderful. He's telling us to live in the present. It is not from wisdom that you ask about the past. Now, he's not saying there you can't remember the past. He's saying there don't live in the past. So what should you do today? Verse 13, consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten out what he has bent? Can I just tell you what that verse means? It means God's in charge and you're not. Consider the work of God. You can't straighten out what he bends and you can't bend what he straightens out. So why are you fretting about things you can't do anything about? Just consider the work of God. So I want to give you three words here, or three statements to close. First of all, surrender. Because you see, you will not have a good name. You will not make right decisions. You won't have the right worldview. You will not make the right choices. You'll not live in present tense in the right spirit until you've surrendered to God. Second word is seek. Seek the Lord in repentance. Come to Him and say, you know, I don't care what you've done. You can salvage your name today. But it's got to start somewhere. There may be a letter you need to write. There may be an apology that you need to make. There may be something that you need to repay someone. But you can salvage your name, but you can't wait till tomorrow because there's no promise of tomorrow. Seek. And the third is set, S-E-T. Set your face toward making the right investments. In your time, in your choices, in your name, with your integrity, with your relationship with God. Set your face in the right direction. Because one day, your chair is going to be empty. And they're going to come to a funeral and they're going to say something about you. And they're either going to have to make it up or they'll have more to say that's good than they can possibly imagine. I remember one lady who came to a pastor. And this man had been active in the church. He had been very active, had been a deacon, had been all kinds of things in the church. And the lady came to the pastor during the visitation time at the funeral home. And she asked if she could see him for just a moment. He said yes. Because, you know, those of us who are preachers, sometimes we preach people into a better life than they lived. Because we want to make the family happy, not because we want to tell the truth. You can preach the Word of God and not mention a lot of things. But this woman pulled this preacher aside and said, "Preacher, I don't care what you say. You can talk about how much he served on committees and how he was a deacon and how he was a friend to you and everything else. But whatever you do, don't you tell this crowd that he was a good daddy, because his children will know you're a liar." You see, that man made a name in the church, but he had a different name at home. Make sure you've got a good name with the people that matter, not just with the people you're trying to impress. Because with the people that matter, when that empty chair is there one day at Thanksgiving and at Christmas, what they remember, you cannot change, good or bad. Would you stand with me with heads bowed and eyes closed?